Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find us online at thecommonwealthclub.org or commonwealthclub.org on Facebook and Twitter and on YouTube. I'm Farai Chidea, your moderator for the night. I'm a political journalist, cultural analyst, and educator, now teaching at New York University, and I'm also a senior writer who covers politics and many other things for 538. In order to survive and thrive, I've had to be different things at different parts of my career. And like so many of us, I've lived by learning and adapting and changing, in other words, leading an episodic career. I recently published a book called The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. And the process of continual job changes and career reinvention means different things for different people. There's healthy disruptive innovation that creates jobs in whole new fields. And then there are those people who find their jobs and their lives disrupted. I'm honored to be here in San Francisco with a deeply talented group of people to drill down on the personal and practical ways that Americans are reinventing the notion of careers. And we'll also ask how to build healthy cities for both high income and low income workers and everybody in between. So going from my far right, we've got Justin Dangle. He's an entrepreneur investor and a keen observer of the intersection of jobs and politics. The Bostonian has launched several companies, most recently Goji, America's largest online auto and home insurance agency. Next to him is Kimberly Bryant, an electrical engineer and founder of Black Girls Code. Their mission is to introduce programming technology and in-demand skills to young women of color so they become tech innovators who design their own personal futures. Ben Casanoca is a technology entrepreneur and former chief of staff to LinkedIn CEO Reid Hoffman, and the two of them have co-authored just a couple of bestsellers. The Alliance, Managing Talent in the Networked Age, and The Startup of You, Adapt to the Future, Invest in Yourself, and Transform Your Career, which I personally recommend to all the millennials in my life, as well as people who are older than 30. thank you all for joining me tonight. Glad to be here. So what we're going to talk about here is a couple of different things. One is the changing nature of careers in America. There used to be, for a time, this idea that careers were supposed to be like an escalator. You got on at the bottom, you went up, you gained seniority, you got off at the top, you got your gold watch, and you went off into a happy retirement. In fact, my grandparents used to collect Norman Rockwell plates, and they didn't have this on a plate, but I found a Norman Rockwell print of something called Retirement Cruise, and it shows this happy couple, seniors, kind of with a seagull floating by, and, you know, this vision of not only a life of good work, but a good life after you have finished working. And today, that is being troubled in many different ways. The average lifespan of a job is 4.4 years now, and that is average for everyone. For millennials, it's far shorter. The upside for the millennials is that they realize that they're going to be, you know, changing jobs kind of the way people used to change their wardrobes. But for a lot of people, the constant demand of change has proved to be disconcerting, and the reality also is that the average length of unemployment for people who are 50 plus is a year, 53 weeks. So when you're younger, if you go through a period of unemployment, you can recover more quickly. And as you get older and you have more seniority, you also are at risk of having longer unemployment right at the time when you're trying to finish saving money for retirement. So all of these things are setting the backdrop for the conversation we're going to have tonight about how technology is shaping the future, and also, you know, how do we build cities that are functional for everyone. But I want to start with you, Ben, because in your book, The Alliance, you talk about a concept of tours of duty that deals with some of the questions of what happens to the relationship between employers and employees in a time where there is rapid change of jobs. Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, I think you set the stage nicely, and I think this new world of work and this new economy has implications for both individual professionals and how an individual takes control of their career in the ways that you talk about in your book, and for managers seeking to effectively recruit and manage those sorts of employees. So I think for individual professionals of any age, millennial or older, as you said, this expectation that a company is going to take care of you, invest in you, retrain you from cradle to grave is not realistic. And in fact, every professional needs to be responsible for their own learning. They need to be investing in themselves in order to get ahead. Our metaphor is, you know, treat your career like a startup. You have to be the CEO of your career, even if you're an employee at someone else's firm, and adapt yourself in the exact same way that startups adapt their businesses, how entrepreneurs adapt their businesses. And then I think for managers and companies, this new employee mindset, which is really critical for individual survival, raises some interesting questions for how companies and CEOs and managers ought to think about their workforce. Companies can no longer afford to guarantee employment, and it's unwise for them to do that because they need a continually changing workforce, right? As globalization and technology has forced companies to adapt and change, they too need employees who can adapt and change. So the idea of hiring someone just out of college and sort of having this compact where you pledge loyalty to us and we'll guarantee employment to you, which for so long I think has characterized the employer-employee relationship, that's over. And so what we advise companies to do is say, look, you may not spend the rest of your career at our company, and we don't even want to guarantee that employment. We can't guarantee that employment. So instead, let's make a commitment to each other that we can both keep. Let's commit to each other for a realistic period of time, what we call a tour of duty, that might last between 2 to 4 years. And it will be a tour of duty in which we will invest in you if you invest in us. So we will invest in helping make your career more adaptable in the long term, because we know you're going to have a long career, many different companies, many different industries. If you commit to us and stick around for longer than a year or whatever your millennial itch might be, right. Like you don't just leave the moment there's a better opportunity, but you actually stay and do great work. And so we kind of reclaim some of the predictability that we've lost in this dog-eat-dog economy, but at the same time, we don't talk about something that we both know is unrealistic, which is lifetime employment. And so constructing and thinking about employment as a series of tours of duty in which an employee might spend 10 years at a company or might spend 1 year at a company, but at regular intervals is making sure that the employee's learning new skills and going to be adaptive in the modern economy, and that the company has a real need for that employee as the organization changes. So it's a fundamentally different kind of compact, a whole new sort of relationship where the employees are not family anymore. We call them allies. And that's a psychological shift. It's a new approach to work, but I think it's an approach that the companies that are winning today are having to make.
Now, Kimberly, I want to back into the story of how and why you created Black Girls Code. But I want to start by asking you what you tell your daughter. And tell us again how old she is. I think she's 14 now, is that right?
Oh, 17.
17!
Just turned 17.
Time flies. Okay. So what do you tell her about the world of work?
Well, I would say for my daughter as well as for the girls that are in our program, I had a conversation with someone else about this today, is that we really teach them to be flexible in terms of what their career options are. So this once thought that, you know, they get these tech skills and they go work for a Google or a Microsoft or an Apple, that may not necessarily be the case, especially for Generation Z. And I think they accept that and they own that and are looking at the world of work in a much more dynamic way than we have in the past, even different than millennials have. They're looking at that they may have to create the career that they're going to have tomorrow. So for my daughter, you know, I really encourage her, and she went on this interesting journey of wanting to be a video game tester than play games all day. That's like was her ideal job in the world at the age of 12, to this journey that where she's now like, well, you know, I do want to learn to code, but, you know, I'm really going to be the boss and create this company, this game design company, and have other people that are working for me and create these opportunities. And that's kind of like what I try to encourage in all of the girls is this mindset of that they're going to be able or may have the opportunity to create, as you said, their future, whatever that is going to be, around something that really drives them and inspires them in whatever field that is in.
And tell us the origins of Black Girls Code, particularly as it relates to how your daughter was getting some tech enrichment, but with a little bit of a twist.
Yeah. So the twist was, as I mentioned, my daughter just turned 17 just a few days ago. But when we started Black Girls Code, before it even was an idea, she was going into middle school. And what this kid loved to do all day, every day, all she did was play these video games. At that time, it was a Game Boy, which is obsolete now, I think. It's like a retro type of game these days. But that was her thing. She'd play these games. She was even playing games offline. She was in Dungeons and Dragons. She was doing World of Warcraft. She really was a really, really heavy gamer. That was what she was interested in. And so as she was going into middle school and I was looking for all these opportunities to get her off of the computer, I found a summer camp that taught her how to be a game creator. And so her whole world opened up at that time. She didn't even realize that you could actually create these things that she was playing. And so as I was looking at this classroom of students when we were at the summer camp at Stanford, it was not diverse at all. So it was just like really that's like a handful of girls in this classroom and lots of boisterous middle school boys. So I was like, oh my gosh, this is interesting. And for my daughter, she found that she did not feel necessarily connected to this community. You know, being a girl in middle school with boys don't necessarily want the girls or think the girls can play these games, nevertheless create them. It was a bit of isolation for her, and then being a student of color, that was even more because she was the only student of color in this class. So I, at that time, was going through a career transition myself and had just left corporate America and was like, I'm never going back to corporate America. I don't know what it is I'm going to do. I'm going to try to figure out something, create a startup, I don't know, but I'm not going back to corporate America. And so I was kind of in limbo at the time, so not really planning on starting a nonprofit, but trying to find my way. And this opportunity opened up because I saw that it was a gap. There weren't really any organizations at that time that were really focused on teaching kids to code at all. Nevertheless, teaching girls, and nevertheless, even more so teaching girls of color from these underrepresented backgrounds. And so having this opportunity and some time on my hands and a little bit of a 401k savings to help out and then really, really being driven as a mom to make sure that my daughter wouldn't drop out. You know, this was like she started out wanting to be a vet and then she wanted to be an artist. And I was like, oh, my God, this kid is never going to eat. And that cannot live with me. And then going now to becoming a video game tester. We had gone through the iterations that every parent goes to, and then she landed here. And I saw, you know, like it really opened up. You can see, you know, as a parent, you know when a kid gets really excited about something and you want to keep to nurturing that talent. And that was where I was. And so it started out with just that, you know, just me from a mother's perspective, like, I want to be sure, because I'm an engineer too, and I've gone through this path. I was like, I want to be sure that my baby is in a supportive and nurturing environment, and I want her to be able to do what she loves. And that's how Black Girls Code, you know, began just out of that, and we've become this, you know, national, international organization now with reaching many, many girls across the U.S. and abroad and really getting them on this path to start these careers in tech.
And Justin, you have started three different companies, most recently Goji, and I have been to your offices, seen a very diverse staff, and you are someone who, in addition to being an entrepreneur, also has a background of studying political science. You are a true political aficionado, and we chop it up all the time about politics. So what I want to ask you is this portal of technology and technology specifically as a force in the American economy inclusive of all the people it needs to be? If not, what are the mechanisms that could make it more so, whether it's policy or otherwise? And you know, thinking more about income inclusivity as well.
I think that is the fundamental question right now of the era in labor that we're living through. We've seen an era where it's really wonderful to be in tech. It's really wonderful to be an entrepreneur. People in this generation have more opportunities if they are well-educated, well-trained, entrepreneurial than ever before. But it's also been an era where we've seen income stagnate for most people, and we haven't seen the inclusive economy that we might like to believe in. And I think the mantra today is really what's good for Silicon Valley is good for America, the way we used to say what's good for General Motors is what's good for America. But the question I think we have to ask ourselves is that true? And it, at least from a correlation perspective, this has been an era where people in Silicon Valley, people in Boston, where I'm from, have done quite well, but people in other parts of the country haven't. And I think that we need to start to ask ourselves a question about how this new labor model is going to be inclusive and is going to work for people. And we've gone through an era where, as many people have discussed, unions have largely declined. They've been replaced by this open model, which, like I said, is great for me, so I love it, but isn't great for everybody. And we're headed perhaps to a 1099 model, where models like Uber and others, where people aren't even really technically employees of the entity that they effectively work for, become a major force in labor markets. So I think that to answer the question sort of in two parts, sort of one is what can we do from a how should we be thinking about this from as tech companies and from a public policy perspective? And the second layer, how can we think of it as individuals and how to thrive, particularly people that maybe aren't necessarily gonna win the lottery and work at Google? So from a public policy perspective, I think that we need to be very cautious as new models emerge that are essentially are regulatory arbitrage. So if we look at entities that are doing things that used to be regulated in a certain way and are simply stepping outside of it. I mean, the most obvious is something like a DraftKings, which is trying to essentially make gambling legal by calling it something else. Or we look at things like Uber, where, you know, fleet management perhaps should be independent drivers, perhaps shouldn't be. And I think we need to be very thoughtful on a case-by-case basis. And I think we as entrepreneurs that see ourselves as a part of as contributing an important part of the labor force need to be thoughtful about how we build a model that works for everybody. On an individual level, I think that the individual and particularly municipal level, I think that the solution is actually a little bit different than what many people think. I think most people think of yourself as training yourself, think of yourself as evolving your career and staying ahead of the skills game. I think it's much more about being part of a community. I think if you're part of a community, you'll be able to find jobs and opportunities. You'll understand information. I know this is something that Ben talks a lot about. You'll be able to understand informationally what the next move is. And I think that part of the solution to this problem is to look to strengthening communities across the country in ways that actually help people find their next job and help people when things aren't going well, provide resources for people. And there's some really amazing experiments going on out there in this regard. I think the Downtown Project in Las Vegas, Tony Hsieh's project, which cultivates a community that isn't just about work. It's not just about entrepreneurship. It's about cultivating relationships between people so that as their careers evolve and as the security that labor unions and the social safety net used to provide isn't there, that security is replaced by something else. And there's a lot of exciting things like that going on. And, you know, just to answer that last question, I think about, you know, one of the most interesting things about the last 20 years that we've seen is when the internet really emerged 20 years ago, people thought that work and wealth concentration would disperse. that if you could be living in rural Virginia or rural South Dakota or New York City, and because of the internet, you could telecommute and make just as much money as you could elsewhere. And of course, exactly the opposite has happened. And I think a lot of communities, and the Downtown Project is another example of this, have asked the question, why? And it turns out that if you create an environment that is attractive for lots of social and cultural interaction, it turns out that that's what breeds the sort of entrepreneurial spirit that seems to be thriving the most in this economy. And so I think that's one of the public policy solutions that people are thinking about.
And I want to just run down the row and ask each of you to answer this question. In my book, The Episodic Career, I talk to everyone from a self-made billionaire who never went to college to a woman who for many years was a drug addict and street prostitute and retrained as a skilled shipboard welder, and many people very much in the middle of those kind of extreme life experiences. But as I look at the statistics from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, two of the fastest growing jobs in America are home health care aid and basically physical therapy aid. Both of those pay less than $25,000 a year. And the home health care aid is particularly important because we have the boomer generation aging and people also living longer. People who are the silent generation living longer. So that's socially valuable work that's not being well compensated. How do we even live in mixed income cities? I'm not talking about mixed income neighborhoods, but just mixed income cities when we have, you know, some people who do socially valuable work that's just not well compensated. Do you see any...
But one nuance, I haven't seen that data, but I suspect the highest paid home health care aide makes a lot more than $25,000. So that might be the average. What's interesting is look at the distribution. I do think there are premiums going to the highest skilled or most capable in a lot of professions, but it is I'd be curious what you guys think, but a winner-take-all market, not only in industries, but even at the level of the occupation. So the super wealthy are going to pay a huge premium to the most capable home care person. I do think the takeaway for me on those professions is in America, the jobs of the future, I think, are going to involve that humans can do, are going to involve being able to be empathetic, being able to communicate, being able to form relationships, and apply sort of subjective judgment. You know, think of the things that are hard to automate or offshore, jobs that have that characteristic. So when I think about those two jobs, they're very high on the, you have to look a human in the eye, you have to read their body language, you have to touch them at the right time and assure them that things are okay, you have to sort of see that they're stressed and maybe do something else. And I think those sorts of skills run through a range of jobs that I think are going to still exist in America 10 years from now, and that are, I think, for the people who really master them, are going to pay substantially more than those amounts. That would be my prediction.
I tend to disagree with that. I see a lot, especially, you know, being in the Valley or being near the Valley and working in Oakland, I see a lot of disconnect with income distribution and wealth distribution just here in the Bay Area. Even we don't even have to go across the bridge. We can see it right here in some of our communities like Bayview, Hunters Point, et cetera. And I see a lot of commoditization of these skills like that. We see this already. We've been talking about this for years with our teachers and the low salaries that our teachers get. And I would, you know, say I would argue that that's one of the most important jobs or career paths, you know, for our future generation as teachers. They still are tremendously underpaid. Now that I've been in the nonprofit side and we work with youth every day, there is no way teachers shouldn't make five times as much they do. This is a lot. You know, this was not my field before, but now working with youth, they deserve to be paid and compensated fairly, and they're not. So I think that we really have to take a more nuanced look at how we compensate people, how we provide fair costs of housing and living. I mean, in the Bay Area, these things are like right at the forefront for me. How do we compensate people on top of the salary that they take home so that they can have a fair quality of life? Because I don't think just waiting on market forces to kick in and provide people with what they need, even to live right here in the Bay Area, I don't think that's working. So I think if you look at it from a Silicon Valley lens, it tends to suggest, oh, market forces will take care of that, but it doesn't. And people do not have a place to live. People cannot afford housing here. People cannot afford to send their kids to a quality school. So looking at how we can inject policy changes, for me, this is just my perception, my opinion, it has to happen so that we have communities that have a more equal income distribution and even a more equal, I would say, quality of life opportunity for people that are doing these jobs that are going to remain on the fringes as we automate and automate more things.
Justin?
Yeah, I'm inclined to, I guess, come out more on Kimberly's side of this issue, which is to say that I'm reminded of a Silicon Valley venture capitalist who I met with once, who's told me, we haven't found the $1 billion company that we can invest in that only needs 40 people, but we're looking. And the truth is the technology is great and makes our lives better in many ways, but most of the big tech companies, relative to their size and relative to their non-tech comps, require very few people. And the people that can work there actually do quite well. But this question started with the question of home health aids. And if you've been following the healthcare space at all, what's been going on is following the Affordable Care Act is a pitch battle between payers, mostly health insurers, and providers who are wrestling about cost and payment. And the people getting squeezed tend to be the people at the bottom of that labor spectrum. And this is a drama that's played out over and over again. This is not going to be an easy problem, I think, for us to solve as a society, but I think for us to succeed, we're going to need to. And I think we're seeing it in our politics right now. You know, most people living in San Francisco, New York, and Boston predicted pretty easy nomination battles for Secretary Clinton and former Governor Bush, and that didn't happen. And it didn't happen in part because I think we're seeing some of this labor squeeze going on around the country, and it is affecting our politics. So the way out of it, some of it is going to be a policy response, and some of it has got to be some really thoughtful entrepreneurs that figure out how to use, how to put people to work in ways that generate enough value and income, so that people at the people doing jobs at the bottom of the spectrum can actually make a living wage. And Uber is, I think, the Uber model, the 1099 model, is dangerous because if we end up with if Uber ends up being an irresponsible company with a natural monopoly across a number of markets and intends to start to squeeze the wages of its 1099 drivers, that's going to be a problem. But if you think about it instead and say, hey, this is actually a way to make labor much more efficient by deploying it more regularly, it's a way to give people the sort of freedom that entrepreneurs often enjoy today, then it can work out quite well. And so I think there's an opportunity in front of us and a danger in front of us. And I think we, as I think that we're going to have to ask our public officials, entrepreneurs like myself and people running large companies are going to have to be very thoughtful. So there's a lot of encouraging signs. I think if you have a conversation today in Silicon Valley, talking about impact and talking about social welfare is a part of almost every conversation that I've had. I'm only speaking personally and anecdotally, whereas out here a half decade or a decade ago, it wasn't. And so there's hopeful signs, but there's a lot of danger. And I think I hope that the Valley and Wall Street and entrepreneurs like myself realize that while this has been a great era for us, it's left a lot of it's left most people out.
Do you think the social impact of Uber is complicated versus entirely or mostly positive?
I think it's complicated.
And
I think
what
I think we don't
costs?
Know yet is the short answer. So okay. We don't actually know. So
what are the social costs of Uber?
The potential social costs of Uber are so let's imagine that you lived in my home city in Boston and you were a taxi driver starting in the 1970s and you saved up a whole bunch of money and spent $500,000 buying yourself a taxi medallion, thinking that asset was going to be your retirement asset. And then Uber comes along and all of a sudden changes the labor model so that people can easily compete with you. And the city doesn't step in and say that UberX needs to be regulated drivers. Now, I'm very happy about it because I love taking Ubers everywhere. Most citizens are too, but for that taxi driver, his reality has changed quite a lot. And let's imagine we go 10 years down the line from where we are today, and Uber has largely driven most taxis out of business, has beaten Lyft, and has a natural monopoly on transportation in most cities, and decides, I don't think they will, by the way, I don't think they will do this, because I actually think that the folks that run it are mostly pretty responsible people. But if they decide that instead of, let's say, taking 20% of fares, they want to take 60 or 70% of fares, then all of a sudden a whole bunch of drivers are going to be making a lot less money, and we'll end up with a system that doesn't actually materially lower the cost of transport because they have a natural monopoly, and doesn't really work workforce-wise. So those are two possible futures for us, and we don't actually really know which one we're going to live through. But it's an important consideration for Travis Kalanick and Ryan Graves and the people running Uber, for the mayors of various cities, and for us as a society.
Now, I just wanted to throw in a couple of data points from, some of the research I did for the book. The value of a New York City taxi medallion has basically gone down by $500,000. It was as high as $1.3 million. And so
I would add that anyone who's paying $650,000 for a New York City taxi cab medallion is wasting their money right now.
Well, yeah. I mean, and so what's happened is that the resale market, so first of all, people used to buy medallions and then sort of rent them out to all these other people. But the resale market and the rental market for those medallions has totally crashed. That doesn't mean that this disruption is inherently bad, but it certainly is bad for people, as you mentioned. But
one thing I wanted to add on that is that I think, there's other use cases. If we look at the Uber model, which is interesting and complicated, where, I see lots of people like in East Bay or in other places in inner cities that I have gone that are either unemployed or underemployed and can quite easily go and start working for Uber or Lyft and add $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 to their income when this is a person without, BA, college degree, et cetera, and maybe unemployed. So there's positives to that as well. I also think, though, that Uber has disrupted an industry, and now we are in a place with Uber and Lyft where it's time to look at innovative models. So I think the deficiency that I see with Uber is that there's no sharing of the profit model with any of those drivers. They're not making, the money that the company as a whole is billion-dollar valuation. They're not being able to actively participate in that profit generation that their labor is actually generating for the company. So I think the models that use this 1099 platform in the future are going to be most successful when they can figure out how to turn back some of the profit that the company is generating to the workers. We don't really have strong models for that now, but I think that's the future of the companies that will really be successful in that type of an economy.
Yeah, I just wanted to throw out, there were a couple more things that had come up. One was that I was in an Uber, and the driver, in New York, they recently cut their fares, but the driver said that he was forced to absorb the whole cut and it was not split between the company. He's like, I'd be okay if they split it 50-50. Mm-hmm. But to add to your point, I have met so many people who have survived through the down economy by becoming Uber drivers. And I don't, it is such a mixed bag. Like I met a guy who is a felon. And of course, felony records in most cases, in many states, really crush your employment prospects. And this was his venue back into the working world after leaving jail. So this is a complicated thing. But let me run through, three questions, and I'm just going to see.
Right. Can I just add one thing on the
1099
thing? So just on the 1099.
This is directly it. So it's like, is the new gig economy really the next slave economy of haves and have-nots? Mm. And then how will the 1099 economy adapt to retirement and Social Security funding? But say whatever you were going to say, and if you have any thoughts on those points to add.
Yeah, I really just wanted to clarify what I'd said before, which is that, and agree in large part with Kimberly, which is this is an opportunity for us to revise the way labor is going to work in the future. The opportunity is possible that we could end up with a much better work reality that actually solves this inclusion problem. But it's also quite possible that if we don't think about regulating natural monopolies and things like this, that we could end up with an economy that works way worse for people. So the point of view is not to say that Uber isn't potentially a way better reality. The reality of being, let's say, a taxi driver in Boston, where I'm from, was actually largely pretty bad under the medallion system. Most of the medallions were owned by people that weren't driving. The largely immigrant drivers were squeezed for about 30,000 in payments for those medallions out of the 75,000 or so that they were gross. So this really wasn't an ideal system either. The labor model where a third of people were part of unions and had pensions, retirements, et cetera, that model has been long in our rearview mirror. And this potential 1099 economy does open up the opportunity. My view is that we need to be thoughtful about it. And I don't want to live through another era where people that aren't lucky enough to have gotten a great education, that aren't lucky enough to be entrepreneurs and innovators, get left out. So my hope is that both entrepreneurs, government, et cetera, that we can figure out a way to work together in this new era. And I really agree with Ben that we are headed into a very different, we are in the midst of a radical transformation in our labor markets. And I'm hoping that we'll be thoughtful.
And so let me just say that this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are speaking with Justin Dangle, who we just heard, an entrepreneur, seed investor, and someone who is also very much a political aficionado. Kimberly Bryant, electrical engineer and founder of Black Girls Code, and Ben Casanoca, technology entrepreneur who has co-authored bestsellers The Alliance and The Startup of You. I'm Farai Chidea, your moderator, and you can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see our program videos on our YouTube channel. So, Ben, I want you to dive back into the 1099 economy, but adding one more question, because this is really generated a lot of questions. With driverless car technology coming in the next 2 to 10 years, our Uber and Lyft drivers will disappear. What does the future work for them?
This question of does technology eliminate jobs or create jobs has been long running for many decades, and economists have been debating it and continue to debate it up to this point. And I think there are some very smart people on both sides of the equation. So there are people who say, yeah, self-driving cars will eliminate not just Uber and Lyft drivers, but the trucking economy, all the people that drive trucks for a living, delivery people, FedEx people. I mean, you go down the list, there are a lot of people who drive for a living. What's going to happen with those jobs? We don't know. But we do know is that as technology and innovation continue, new industries, entirely new product lines will be created. Who would have thought today that tens of thousands of people today repair iPhones for a living? Or massage therapy, this idea that people have so much leisure time and we live in such an era of abundance that there'd be hundreds of thousands of massage therapists would just be unthinkable 40 or 50 years ago. So we don't know. What we do know is that historically the argument that Armageddon is near, that there's going to be massive unemployment because robots are going to do everything, that prediction has been made and that prediction has been wrong time after time and time after again. Now, is this time different? Maybe, but we have to, I think, contextualize the argument in a broad historical context.
So I want to move
totally
on.
Totally agree, by the way.
Yeah. I want to move on to some questions of models for the future and, how we should look at income. So you brought up the example of trucking, and I had spoken with one of the co-founders of Union Square Ventures, one of the partners in Union Square Ventures, who said, long-haul trucking is precisely the kind of job that should be automated, like when people are driving 18 hours a day. But the question still remains, what happens to the former truck driver? Mm-hmm. And so he's an advocate of universal basic income as a solution. And universal basic income is this idea that you would get rid of a lot of current social programs, but what you would do is give everyone a check. And Switzerland has been considering this, but I find it interesting that some of the proponents in the U.S. are precisely quite wealthy tech entrepreneurs. The person who I spoke with was Albert Wenger, who has a great blog called Continuations, among many other things. But, you know, he's a big fan of universal basic income because he thinks it will encourage entrepreneurship, among other things, so that if you start a company and then you go through a fallow period, you know that you can last it out, but also for workers who find themselves in what some people call the jobless future, which I don't think it actually is a jobless future, but it's an uncertain future, that you can ride out these periods. So I wanted to, again, sort of run down the line. So there's one question, do we need to raise the minimum wage? And another one, do we need to look at models like universal basic income? What do you see, either if it's either or neither, what do you see as some ways of changing the system? Anyone can jump in.
So I'm... would very much support a universal basic income, particularly over a minimum wage increase. I think it's there's lots of reasons to think that the meaningfully expensive network of social programs we have could best be consolidated into a simple program which guaranteed a minimum basic standard of living. I think it morally as a country, I think it would make more sense. And I think that there's ways that it could be done that actually wouldn't materially raise aggregate spending in the country. So I think that's a strong proposal, and versus a minimum wage law, where I think that economists have debated whether or not minimum wage destroys employment. I think everyone who's taken basic microeconomics has seen a model that says that it does. Most of the sociology says it doesn't. The truth is we don't actually know exactly where the breakpoint is. We don't know what we can raise minimum, what can we raise minimum wage to without destroying employment. And the truth is what we actually really care about is making sure that everybody has a minimum, or at least what I care about is making sure that everyone has a minimum, a dignified standard of living. And I think guaranteeing a minimum income is probably the most effective way to do it. And it's interesting for the history of that proposal, which is sometimes referred to as a negative income tax, comes from the conservative economist Milton Friedman.
We got another question that said, well, isn't universal basic income just another form of communism? So there's definitely some robust debate about that. Does anyone else want to weigh in, or should I move on to another
question? The answer is no.
But do you think, I haven't thought hard enough about I've seen the commentary on universal basic income. I don't have a point of view myself, and minimum wage, I just echo what was just said by Justin. I do think we should distinguish between there are things within each of our controls, that in terms of things we can do today, tomorrow, next week, to sort of be more competitive in the future individually, and then there's a set of very interesting policy questions and debates. So, for example, on the policy side, not just minimum wage, universal income, but things like job retraining and job reskilling. The federal government of the U.S. today spends billions of dollars across over 200 distinct job retraining programs. Nobody knows if the money is used effectively. The people's intuition is that it's all being wasted. And so how do we reskill and retool people who are in hard-run manufacturing towns to figure out how they can get a job in the modern economy? What role should government play in that process? Don't know. It's an interesting debate. I also think, though, for each of us individually, we ought to stay focused on what are the things we can do, because nobody, even if you have a college education today, even if you're sitting in this room today, there's no guarantee that any of us will have a job 10 or 15 or 20 years from now if we stop investing, if we stop learning and growing. And so I think we want to distinguish between the two, and the policy debate's very important, but sometimes that can get frustrating because it will feel so outside of our control at times.
And to that point, there were a couple of questions directed at you, Ben. One says, you talked about soft skills like communication and empathy as the future. What's the best way, in your opinion, for people to gain these skills, seeing that a lot of schools and colleges don't teach them? And a second question said, how do you view the 1099 economy and, sort of like how do you blend soft skills with technical skills, or is it one versus the other? So any thoughts on that?
I think everyone might learn differently. I think one of the most important things to ask yourself is, am I surrounded by people who I respect or admire? Am I surrounded by people who have the skills that I want to possess? I would say on these softer, mushier things like empathy, relationship building, We often learn through osmosis. We observe people around us interacting in a certain way. We model behavior based on people around us. So we often say, you know, you are the average of the five people you spend the most time around. Your network does shape your destiny. I really truly believe that. Obviously, you can read books and take classes and stuff, but even in fields like management and business, most of us have learned by watching what our manager did to us or what a colleague did in a meeting and observing. So make sure you're surrounded by the right people. I'd say that's a good general rule for any sort of skill development.
And completely agree with that, by the way. And yeah. I think I may have said earlier, I think that for individuals, regardless of where you are, embracing your community and developing strong relationships within it are how you're going to find opportunities to thrive in this type of an economy. It's the way information is shared. It's the way companies usually get started. It's the way you find your next job. And so I think it's a little bit counterintuitive. People think about individual skill development and taking courses as the way to really be a strong part of this economy. I'm unconvinced that that's really the case. I think in many ways it's becoming more embedded within your community. And places like Downtown Project in Las Vegas that are promoting more community action are taking areas that have not succeeded, parts of our country that have not succeeded as much in this new economy, and making them quite a bit more successful by developing that community spirit.
And Kimberly, I wanted to throw at you a question that dealt with skills acquisition. And in some ways, I think about this as the parents of the girls that you are educating. Mm-hmm. So it says here, you know, companies are increasingly requiring technical skills as part of jobs that didn't require them even 5 years ago. So how do people reinvent themselves and be competitive in the job market if they didn't have technical abilities? What are their prospects? But I just also wonder, I want your thoughts on that, but also when there are girls in your program, how do their parents relate mm-hmm. to, you know, the future that they see through their children's eyes?
Well, I think one of the good things about being at this time that we are now is that there's lots of access, potentially, to gaining skills outside of a classroom. So, you know, there are free courses that you can take at Harvard, Stanford, Princeton, you name it. And the ability to have this access to information is freer than it probably has ever been, at the same time that, you know, more formal education costs are steeply climbing. So I think the opportunity to tap into opportunities to retrain yourself are there because there's this access that we are at an unprecedented that we haven't had before. So I think being able to look at opportunities to tap into these groups and these communities where you can learn a new skill, that you can learn how to code in a group, you can learn how to do data science by taking an online Stanford course, etc. Those are opportunities that we really try to teach our girls and teach themselves. So we only teach so much. I cannot teach the girls everything they could possibly do in technology, although I would love to do that. But we're really teaching them to learn and teaching them how to take this one basic skill set, be it HTML, CSS, be it mobile app development, and then learn the next skill and then the next one. Because we know that this generation of learners, you're going to have to be very nimble and very flexible and be able to teach yourself what you need to get to the next level and the next job, etc. So a lot of that is also what we kind of share with the parents, is giving them access to these resources or pointing them in the direction, and in some cases even training them to learn alongside their students and their daughters and their sons. So that they become active learners as a household and as a family. So we've seen like lots of parents that have come through our courses that, you know, may be a rental agent and that's what they do in their careers, but they've gone and learned how to be a Python coder because their daughter was doing
that's
that.
Great.
And so that's kind of what we try to encourage, is that this opportunity to learn and become an active participant in this economy, it's not just for the youth, it's for everybody. And there's going to be opportunity for everybody, regardless of age, regardless of gender. And we just want to give everybody those skill sets.
Now, here's a question that I'm going to answer in part myself and then toss it to you, Justin. So it says, it seems as though the future you describe requires a level of mental and financial flexibility that far exceeds people's expectations and abilities today. How do people develop those skills? Can they? And so in the episodic career, I talk about a lot of people who were completely unprepared for, I mean, most people in America are living paycheck to paycheck. And if you think about the range of the average length of unemployment right now is 28 weeks. That's not one paycheck, you know, and it's less for younger people, more for older people. And so there are so many stories that, you know, in one case, a man nearly became homeless, but what saved him besides his community of friends was that he was standing in like soup kitchen lines. And he was doing job counseling, basically, for people in the line, and he's now an employment counselor because he was so good at it. But in general, most people have not budgeted. You know, my grandparents were Depression babies, and, you know, I always like to say they could squeeze a nickel and make it into two dimes. And that's just not a skill we have today. Justin, what are mechanisms? Some people have talked about the need for more instruments or different instruments to allow people to save for retirement, but also just to deal with daily living. How do we raise our financial IQ, I guess is what I'm asking.
That's a hard question. I think that there was a really interesting book that came out this year by two Nobel Prize winning economists, George Akerlof and Robert Shiller, that actually talked a little bit about the what we've learned from psychology and neuroscience about some of the cognitive limitations that people have. And understanding finance and savings is something that is actually really challenging. And so it's one of the reasons why I actually started Goji, my last company, was to try to bring more transparency and advice to regular consumers. It's a hard problem. And again, I think that, you know, I feel a little bit guilty on this panel by describing problems and having few solutions. But this is a tricky one, and my hope is that we as entrepreneurs and in the tech world will embrace some regulation of some things that we're doing in order to make sure that the economy is fair. I think that in the financial services world, we've gone through we went through a crisis, obviously, in 2008. There was a lot of legislation, including the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which seems to have made a difference. And I also think that this is my hope and what I'm starting to hear from my friends who work in tech and a number of investors and so forth is sort of a new consciousness that it's important that the outcome not just be financial success of the companies that we build, but also that they contribute to social welfare. And it's hard. Ben, I'd be curious to get your take on this because you're probably spending a little bit more time talking to a more diverse group of people out here. But I think that there is starting to be a recognition that solving these big social problems through tech is actually has to be our shared future.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think one interesting assumption that's run through all the comments this evening is morally prioritizing Americans over other people in the world. So, for example, a lot of what technology does is increase the quality of life for people around the world. So when you talk about offshoring, there's this obsession with Americans have lost jobs. It's like, yeah, but other people in really poor parts of the world gain jobs, and cost for certain services goes down. And, you know, we have a billion people in the world living on a dollar a day or less still, and they're much, much worse conditions than even some of the poorest in America. So obviously from a national policy perspective, there's focus on what's within the borders. But just as we think about the moral implications of technology, I think we should take a non-tribalistic point of view and consider just human welfare in general. I agree, Justin, with the assertion that, or the kind of hope that successful entrepreneurs are increasingly seeing that a more purposeful mission and a mission that seems to do good in the world, those businesses tend to succeed and have a easier time attracting, especially purpose-driven millennials. So I think that's all good. I mean, there's a separate argument about involuntary capitalism is profit evidence of sort of purpose or impact, and to what extent if people purchase services or goods, is that itself a good thing? But I think shooting higher than that aspirationally, I think, is a trend, and we're seeing it here in Silicon Valley. I think we're seeing it in Hollywood with all these sort of more socially relevant documentaries and things. You were probably with some of these people in Cuba. We were in Cuba for New Year's together, and unbeknownst
at the same party.
The same party. Didn't even know we were at the same party. We just met for the first time backstage. But all, you know, documentary filmmakers doing all sorts of things. So I think an idea of how do we increase awareness of challenges in the world, that's a trend that's running through a lot of industries, and it's a cause for hope.
I want to turn to Kimberly. You know, you've worked obviously in the for-profit sector, and now you're working in the nonprofit sector. And we've talked about a lot of different mechanisms for potentially aiding workers in figuring out this new economy. We've talked about regulation. We've talked about government intervention and possibly creating universal basic income. But I'm just curious, particularly from a racial equity standpoint, and one question that someone had was sort of like, why did you do Black Girls Code instead of just a Girls Code thing? Mm-hmm. But there's no question that the racial wealth gap is profound, and it got much worse during the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. And from a racial equity perspective, how do you see, having been on the for-profit and nonprofit side of tech, those two working together or separately to deal with some of the racial equity issues in jobs in general and not just technology?
Well, I think to answer the first question, the reason I started Black Girls Code in particular was because my daughter is a Black girl, and she was the only one in this class, and I know that in my journeys within the Valley and the Bay Area, in tech areas and in tech environments, I found myself to be the only woman of color there as well. So when I looked at the numbers, you know, when I graduated from college and back in the mid-80s, there were about 14 to 12%. There were about 35% of women receiving bachelor's degrees in computer science. Now that's, depending on what poll you look at, it's like 12 to 14. It's drastically declined. And then for women of color, for Black women in particular, it's about 2 to 3%.
What were those years again? You said what was
1985. Yes.
It was 35%.
35%.
Yeah, degrees were by women.
Yeah, yes. Women.
It's dropped in the last one.
The number of computer science degrees has gone up, but the percentage of women has plunged.
Right. Wow. And this is where this is at the same time that other hard STEM careers are increasing. So if you look at chemistry, biology, the curves are going up, but computer science has plummeted. And then if we're looking at Latinas and Native American girls, it's even almost not on the charts. So it's like 1% to 2% or less. So the reason I focused on Black Girls Code and created this organization for those girls is because not only are we not receiving the degrees, but if you look at the industry, when all those numbers started to come out from Google, Facebook, Apple, you saw that those numbers for women were at the highest 5% in these companies. But most, this in 2013, most of the companies didn't release the intersectional data that showed how many of these women were women of color. And now they are releasing that data. You see it's about like what you would expect because we're not graduating. It's 1 or 2%. If you look at women that are also starting companies and the startup getting these VC dollars, it's 1 or 2% at the most. So the VC dollars are not even flowing into these women from underrepresented communities. So the gap is created because of that. Not only are we not seeing women of color employed, we're not seeing them getting the funding to create the next unicorn type companies because VCs are not investing in them. And so the gap is increasing.
One of the interesting dynamics to the community point and sort of the networked age that we write about in the Startup Review and the Alliance is that people tend to build networks and communities of people who look like them.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so
social replication.
We surround ourselves with exactly people who look like us, talk like us, reinforce all of our assumptions and biases. That's what makes us feel comfortable. And so you have that dynamic. And at the same time, you have a philosophy which we've frankly espoused in the Startup Review, and I think you could critique the book in this following sense, which is, well, we espouse a view which is when you hire people, when you choose to work with people, work within your network, right? Work with people you trust. Get introductions to people. That's how you find a job, right? It's classic career advice. But if the networks are all insular of a certain gender or race, then you're going to have white males who naturally only will kind of get introduced to other white males because that's who they know. And so it can reinforce a kind of inequality dynamic. And I actually recently heard from a public company CEO here in the Valley saying he wanted to have a more diverse company, wanted to hire more women, more African Americans, and realized that he didn't actually know very many African American women presently, and yet was still maintaining a sort of policy of only meeting people who came in via an introduction. Yeah. And so he actually has to go outside of his network and community in order to access a talent pool which swims in a different social network.
Well, I kind of push on that notion, though, because I saw this report recently that, you know, when we've had this this thing with 6 degrees of separation that we've all kind of grown up with, 6 degrees of separation. And because I'm on LinkedIn, I'm like, live by LinkedIn. I look at LinkedIn as soon as I meet somebody. What's their LinkedIn? That's my world. I saw that it's rapidly not 6 degrees for me. It's maybe 2, 3 at the very most. And recently a report came out that said it's really only 2 or 3. And I was like, well, there you go. I knew that from LinkedIn. It's only 2 or 3. So I push against this notion that that if you wanted to look outside of your very insular network, you would have to make such a big leap to do so, because you don't. You really only have to go maybe 2, 3 at the most connections to ask a question, and then ask one more question to get to the person that's outside of your bubble. So for me, I was like, no, that's not, you're really not trying. So if women are not coming in and pitching to you and you're a VC, you're not trying, because there are women that are there. There are women that are bringing these companies forward, women that are building these companies, and there's absolutely no reason you should not be able to find them in the network world that we live in right now. That's an excuse. So I think that part of our role as entrepreneurs is to challenge that. When someone says, oh, I can't find women, well, let me open this binder right here that I have for you.
Let me add to that. So, Ben, our mutual friend Julie Hanna today showed me a study from a venture capital firm that showed that companies that had women as part of the founding team had actually outperformed companies that didn't. Mm-hmm. And there's an important idea here, and that's that diversity wins. If you look at a regional level, the great development economist Richard Florida wrote a book, and he pointed out that in our not that recent past, Pittsburgh and San Francisco were roughly equivalent in terms of median income. And he imagines Steve Jobs in the mid-70s walking into a bank in Pittsburgh and asking for a loan. And the idea of this, like, you know, shaggy-haired guy talking about personal computers in Pittsburgh trying to get financing is sort of ridiculous. San Francisco became the most important economic city in this country, probably in the world, because it embraced diversity, because it embraced new ideas, because people with different thoughts mixed. Companies often come out of people blending two ideas together. So I think that there is a bias within Silicon Valley. Some of it's practical. I know when I've founded companies, my co-founders have usually come from my social network, and my investors have usually come from my social network. But we also know that it turns out that diversity wins, that companies with gender diversity tend to do better, that companies that embrace a whole bunch of different ideas and perspectives that come from having a culturally diverse team tend to be better. They tend to anticipate consumer needs. They tend to come up with new ideas that are better. And this is an important idea that is, I think, heterodox in Silicon Valley a lot of the time, but one that I think that there's good news here, because I think that the economic weight will bend in favor of diversity, because diverse companies, I think, do better and will continue to do better, just as diverse cities do.
I'll just quickly interject that in the episodic career, I have a lot of analyses of how diversity works. And one of the troubling things, I mean, the reality is we are human beings with free will. And if we choose to broaden our networks and use them for good, we can. And if we choose to use social replication in a way that insulates us, we can. But there are some troubling statistics about, for example, people using social media particularly in the South, to see who's Muslim and use that as a form of job discrimination. So it's not about social media being bad or networks being bad. I think that, I mean, I totally tout networking as the way to operate. But we also have to realize that we have these personal ethical responsibilities. And so one of the things that I ended up focusing on in the book is if you are a woman, if you are, first of all, women can't negotiate the same way men can. Women can negotiate as hard, but women are asked to make relational pitches for advancement, meaning this is good for the company, whereas men can come in with an offer and say, I'm worth this much, and it's considered okay, whereas it's not considered okay for women. We have to understand that we create this job landscape we live in, and it brings all of the good and bad of us comes with it. So as we wrap up, I just want to ask practical tips. I'll just, you know, run down the line for each of you. You know, what practical tip do you want to say to today's worker that's facing challenges in employment, reemployment, retraining? Ben?
I would consider yourself, as we say in the book, in permanent beta. Always in growth, and embrace the idea that you have bugs and imperfections and areas to grow, and turn that into a life philosophy, even part of one's identity. Especially for recent grads, don't succumb to the illusion that, you know, education's over and now begins work. That's a very dangerous mentality that a lot of people fall into. So never stop investing. And to echo your point, never stop investing in your network, as that's where we tend to learn a lot of the things we need to learn.
Kimberly?
I would say for me, it's a couple things. When we are now in a growth period with our organization, and one of the things that I'm hammering when we're talking to the HR manager is that I want someone who is comfortable with ambiguity. I was like, find me people that are comfortable with ambiguity. That's the people I want, because we're building this train and we're running it down the track at the same time. So I need people that are flexible and that are okay with not knowing where the next step is going to be. And I think of looking at careers in this time, that's kind of what it is taking that first step, finding something where you can thrive and what you actually enjoy doing and provides a living, but being comfortable with not necessarily knowing what the next step and the next step and the next step is going to be, but being open to those opportunities to kind of create this career, this life, or the support that you need to get you there. Yeah.
And Justin?
First of all, I think those are both really good pieces of advice. And I would add that I think that finding something to do that you like actually really matters. Finding people to work with that you really like, finding a company whose values are aligned with yours really matters. And to be patient until you find that is, I think, probably is the best way to find a work situation you like. And I think a lot of people, that the downside to the upside to today's environment is that you can move around a lot. You can find a lot of different opportunities. The downside is that you can face a lot of dislocation in periods where things aren't going well. And I think that if you can recognize and be patient that for part of your life, things are going to go great. For part of your life, things are going to go poorly. But the most important thing is if you find something you love to do and you find people to work with that you really like, that's probably the best thing you can do.
And I would just add that, to tag on to what you said, Justin, that as I researched my book, I found that emotional resilience was one of the most important things. You know, if someone who has been a street prostitute can become a welder, if someone who's standing in a soup line can then become an employment counselor, many things are possible. I think that the balance is between this kind of pie in the sky, everyone can be equally well off, and the fatalistic sense that we're going to heck. Use the word heck. But I think that the truth lies somewhere in between, and that we have great possibilities to shape our own destiny within the constraints of the society that we ourselves created. So on that note, I want to thank Justin Dangle, who is the chairman of Goji.com, Kimberly Bryant, the founder of Black Girls Code, Ben Casanoca, the entrepreneur and co-author of bestsellers, including The Startup of You. I am Farai Chidea, the author of The Episodic Career. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.